We have a rather curious subject this morning, one which many persons have heard about, but very few really know much about, and that is the great cycle of the Grail, which has become one of the most important descents of symbolism in the Christian world. During the Romance period in Europe, there were a long group of troubadours, many poets, literary people, persons in almost every walk of life, religious and secular, who centered their patterns of living around what was called the legend of the quest, the search for the Holy Grail. And in spite of a tremendous amount of research, and the research into hundreds of manuscripts, the problem of the Grail remains very largely unsolved. So this morning we want to approach it a little differently, not dogmatically, to see if we can see a little more of the influence of this tradition, not only upon the people of the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries, but upon the world as it is today. But part of the story seems to come down even into our own time. Where it all began is quite unknown. Probably it is pre-Christian originally. It may have begun in Persia or Chaldea or one of the other nations of the Near East. But it was the story of a search for the most holy relic of Christendom, the Holy Grail, the cup from which Christ drank at the communion of the Last Supper. The fact that the cup continued to exist is variously supported by myth, by legend, and by certain semi-historical accounts. Probably one of the most prominent and common legends is that to the effect that it was brought to Britain by Joseph of Arimathea. He was the one who loaned or gave his tomb for Christ's body to rest in the Holy Sepulchre. Joseph reached England probably around the year 50 or 60 A.D. and is supposed to have brought with him the Holy Grail and the handkerchief of St. Veronica. Veronica herself is said by some to have also been in this small group that under persecution left the Near East, traveled through France, came to the coast of France, and journeyed over to Britain, where they were hospitably received and where the original church of Glastonbury was built. So as far as the English tradition is concerned, Glastonbury becomes the center of the great Grail cycle. Glastonbury is an area in rather swampy land, surrounded by marshes that were known in ancient times as Avalon. And it was to Avalon at the time of his death that Arthur was carried by the mysterious women in the great black barge that took his soul to the afterlife. All of these stories seem to have some kind of a special meaning. The bard sang them, and they were carried through many different cycles of poetry and prose. They appear in the Near East. We find references to them in Islam. But we do not seem to be able to make a solid statement of what is fact and what is fable, what is fanciful and what is symbolical. Perhaps the symbolical development of the story began in Alexandria, which was a mingling ground for practically all of the religions of the world in the period from the 2nd century B.C. to the 3rd century A.D. Here a great many sacred writings were preserved. Here the Gnostics and the Essenes created their schools of thought. the Neoplatonists and the Neopythagoreans, and also here, according to the ancient tradition, the first college of Christianity was established by the Apostle Mark. So there are many stories of this particular series of events or cycles, and perhaps it is useful at this time to consider what the meaning might be. The order of the quest was always more or less the same in the story. It was added to a little and subtracted from a little by different writers, but it centered around three distinct objects. One was the Holy Grail, which was the most important of the hallows, as they were called. The second was the spear of the centurion Longinus, which is supposed to have pierced the side of Christ. And the third is the wreath of thorns. These have been variously sanctified in different parts of the world. Great cathedrals of Europe have declared that they possessed these objects. The problem of trying to verify the story is about as difficult as verifying the mystery of the Shroud of Turin. But in the whole picture of it, one point stands out. It is always a search. Every part of the Grail legend, dealing with Galahad, the guileless knight, Parzival, Lohengrin, and many others, these were all seeking for something. They were searching for a vision. And it is said that Parzival and Galahad attained the vision of the Grail. And that after the death of Parzival, the Grail was taken to India, where it was enshrined in the kingdom of Prester John, the Christian emperor of Asia. All legend, all myth. But where in all of these stories is there something very important? A number of scholars trying to find what was called the hidden church of the Grail finally came to the conclusion that the search was fruitless, that they would never be able to find a church in this world that fulfilled the requirements of this mystery. They finally decided, therefore, that the Church of the Holy Grail was not in the material world, and yet it existed, and that it became part of a great descent of man's aspiration after enlightenment. The search was always the same. The search was for light. The search was for union with reality, and was a great dedication, a pilgrimage toward reality. As we go into this, we find an interesting factor presenting itself. And that is that from the beginning, there is an overtone in the Grail cycle that seems to suggest that in every instance, the Grail search must be an individual effort. There was no way of joining something. There was no way of proclaiming a membership or depending upon a group support for the attainment of the quest. You could not become part of a congregation of the Church of the Holy Grail. Every part of it had to be individual. The individual himself was searching to become one with the communion of saints, with those of the other life who had attained the illumination of the soul. It was therefore the soul in man searching for the eternal soul in life. And this search had to be a personal dedication. Those who achieved the search and finally beheld the Grail became a company apart, but they were never organized as an organization. They became mutually knowing of each other because they had all attained the same level of insight. They were part of a level of internal illumination and not an organization. This seems to meet most of the requirements of the subject, but leads, of course, inevitably to the dedication for the search. A dedication which was part of the vow of knighthood back in the medieval period. The vigil of the Grail was always in a church, and a knight receiving ordination into his order spent the first night in prayer and meditation before the altar of his local church. Having thus dedicated himself internally by a voluntary action of his own, he started out on a quest which no one could assist him. No one could do it for him. No one could walk with him. No one could prevent him from making mistakes. It was a lonely journey, a journey from illusion to light, from darkness to participation in eternal truth. This actually did affect the rise of the Christian faith in the early medieval period. The Grail cycle, regardless of its origin, which may have been among the mystery schools of Egypt, Asia, North Africa, Greece, all of these countries. But wherever it began, it became a key to the religion that had no physical structure, a religion that was entirely subjective, a religion to which each individual made his own commitment, and having made this commitment, either succeeded or failed. In either case, alone. Therefore, perhaps the entire quest of the Grail is best summarized in the words of Plotinus, who observed on occasion that the way to truth was the journey of a lonely person to that which is eternally alone. It was this aloneness that seems to have been the power of the Grail. Each individual had to call entirely upon his own internal resources. He had to train himself, he had to dedicate himself, he had to consecrate himself. He had to master one by one the weaknesses of his own flesh. He had to overcome the pressures and temptations of ambition and avarice. He had to purify his own nature by a vow taken only to the very highest part of himself. He must slowly climb that mountain between his own material nature and the attainment of the enlightenment of his inner soul. It's a very interesting concept and probably has never been fully explored, except that there are records and indications that certain persons apparently achieved this tremendous dedication. Also, it was twisted into the cycle of alchemy at one time, so that the purification of the metals, the transformation of all that is base into all that is sacred, was the great alchemical transmutation performed alone by an alchemist in his little laboratory by prayer and meditation, and on rare occasion by some type of miraculous manifestation. To the Grail cycle, the miraculous was an internal mystery. It did not deal with the commonplace of life. Miracles did not interfere with the workings of universal law. Miracles were inner experiences of attainment, a proof that the reality was nearer than it had been before. The problem of the origin of the Grail, again, has a great many legends associated with it. One legend says that it was carved from the crest jewel of the archangel Lucifer when he fell from heaven. Others say that it was part of the basin of consecration found in the ancient rites of the tabernacle in the wilderness. Some believe that it was the ecstatic cup of Bacchus or Dionysus in Greece. In most cases, it was a chalice in which the individual had to find ways and attain to the possibility of cleansing the inside of his own cup, which was the actual meaning of the term. Now, in doing this thought, or living this way, we find that there arose in North Africa and in early Christendom a teaching that was to become very important in the life of people. And this teaching was the cultivation of the power of internal visualization. In other words, the individual gradually transformed these ideals into inner pictures. These pictures, like the Oriental mandalas, were visualizations of a superior state of being, visualizations which impel the individual to fulfill them or to achieve the mysteries which they represented. And in some of the old English block books and on the continent also, the city of the Grail, or the Church of the Grail, is placed at the top part of the great Ptolemaic system of the solar system. You climb the ladder of the seven planets to reach the entrance of the secret house. This house was above the firmament, and there dwelt together the deity, the triangular trinity, and the abode of the blessed. So the whole concept gradually became a series of self-disciplines by means of which the individual sought to remove from his nature all forms of defilement. Now, the beginning of the Grail journey was always the same. It was, first of all, the realization of a great need. And I think maybe that is where we have to begin our thinking. No matter who we are or how well equipped we are to full life, there are always areas in which desperate need arises. No individual is completely sufficient to his own necessity. Those who think they are simply egotists, because there is no one who can be so protected, either by his own mind or environment or by his worldly goods, that he is free of crisis, free of danger, free of death, disappointment, free of disillusionment and despair. Therefore, the beginning of it all is the concept or realization that we are all imperfect. And also that by the kind of world we live in, the grace of a divine power has made it possible for us to overcome these imperfections in ourselves. The individual can live a good life, a life that is not temporalized by advantages or corruptions. The individual can be a true Christian. But to do this, he must make decisions, and very often he must turn his back on the very church he claims to belong to, because it is not possible for the individual who is dedicated to the search to accept a theology as the basis of his own enlightenment. He must realize that his journey to the Grail is one of dedication, impersonal victory over the weaknesses of nature, the possibility of living nearer and nearer to the love of God by direct personal unfoldment. Therefore, in the search for the Grail, there must first be rites of purification. The individual must gradually, to the best of his ability, put his life in order. He will not be able to do so perfectly, that is understood, but he must make a gradual effort to get over the problems by which he is bound to an inferior state by his own center of consciousness. He must get over all grievances. He must fulfill the commandments of Jesus. He must dedicate his goods to the needs of those who are impoverished. He must give graciously of himself at all times. He must hold nothing and demand nothing. He must never conspire to gain anything for himself, including a conspiracy after truth. He must not have any of these motivations behind his action. There must be only true and simple acceptance and practice of the noblest form of life which he can experience. Now, if by this type of problem or this type of living, he gradually overcomes the major weaknesses of his own nature, he gradually comes into a state of internal tranquility. And tranquility is the open door to the sanctuary of the Grail. Tranquility means peace with reality. It means that the individual accepts without question the true teachings of his religion, whatever it may be, and lives it without restriction or compromise. He must have, therefore, the ability to quiet all of the confusions which beset the average person. Now, confusions are very often things that cannot be overcome easily. Sometimes a life is harassed to the degree that it would not appear that the individual could make a new start in his own inner life. But he can if he will. There is never a time in the life of any living thing that has a consciousness in which that consciousness cannot be released constructively. It is a matter of willingness to be dedicated. Assuming that the person achieves this type of dedication, it might be regarded as an order of knighthood. He becomes the first grade of the search for the Grail. And all the knights dedicated their sword handles, which were the form of the cross, to the good fight, the battle to overcome the darkness in self, and to protect the light in others. The knights of the garter and so forth were always out protecting people in distress and saving the maiden who was in the hands of the villain. The maiden was the soul, which is always in the hands of the villain until the individual redeems himself. So the knighthood of the Grail began by this proof of courage, proof of integrity. The young knight did not know what he was going to find. He had no promise that he would find it. He was simply told that his hope was only through the conquest of himself, that no one else could help him, and all the prayers in the world could not bring him the peace that he had to earn by the development of his own character. And he might pray for character, but if he did not have the courage to live it, it would not come to him. So having gone through all these problems and coming finally to the Gnostic quietude, the individual lacks none of the needs of life, but has an inner tranquility in which he lives in this world, but not of it. He performs all the duties that are his proper responsibilities in life. All effort to escape responsibility is treason as far as the way of the Grail is concerned. The individual must never try to grow by neglecting something else. He must fulfill, according to the best conscience that he possesses, every daily responsibility. He must bear all burdens without complaint. He must recognize that all occurrences are lessons, and that each lesson that comes, the more difficult the lesson, the greater the attainment. And it is upon this climbing this ladder of circumstances, this mysterious stairway of incidents, and conquering them one by one, that he attains to the great gate of the Grail Temple. Having come to this point, then, he settles down to the next step of his growth. Namely, what the Oriental has always known, the meditative arts. The quietude and contemplation enables the individual to relax and allow the best of his own inner life to come through. When we relax, one of two things happens. If we are not too well oriented and pretty much bound to our mistakes, when we relax, we're miserable. When we relax, we have all kinds of negative thoughts. We worry, we're frightened, we're concerned, we're disappointed, we're disillusioned. We think of the people who have mistreated us and how the world is failing us in our needs. So to the person who is not self-disciplined, relaxation and quietude just end in misery, which is what is intended. Because there is no way in which we can accomplish the purpose until we are able to see within ourselves that we have conquered these mistaken points of view. So by degrees, the individual gains the ability to relax and be quiet. Now, this has a sort of an initiation with it. Because when you get to this point, you've got to relax and be quiet. You've got to be able to sit down quietly and in peace with life and in peace with yourself. Contemplate the common problem things that we all have to do. The individual must learn the importance of being able to get along with himself, and that his great enemy has always been himself. And until he conquers that, he can go no further. He is a victim of his own mistakes. He is a victim of his own wrong attitudes, wrong objectives, wrong ambitions, wrong decisions. He is a victim of every lesson he sought to avoid or evade. Every time he fails to do that which is next, he penalizes himself and adds to the burden of his own subconscious mind. So the harrowing of Hades, in the old classical terminology, the descent into limbo, represents the individual cleaning out his own subconscious with which he has to live. It is either a paradiso or a purgatorio according to how he has trained it. If he is selfish, his internal subconscious isn't worth living with. In fact, it would be very hard to live with it. And yet we go along day by day, failing to realize that we are building a toxic subconscious, that we are building an internal life, and the only way we can escape from it is keep our objective consciousness so busy that we have no time to think about the facts of life. We can only be comfortable, so to say, if we can get our minds off of ourselves. And usually we find some useless way of doing it. For instance, when we can't stand ourselves any longer, we turn on the television, and as a result of that, our punishment is magnified. That is the purgatory which we get into as a result of not being able to be quiet and read a good book. Also, the book sometimes can be a problem. But any event, the problem is always the individual running away from himself. He wants to get away from the things about himself he doesn't like. And if he sits down quietly, there are numerous things he doesn't like. But if anyone else points them out to him, they no longer are his friend. They are his enemy if they tell him the truth. And therefore, it's useless for them to tell him the truth. He won't believe it. He will only hate them. He must find it for himself. He must live with his own mistakes until he can face them. And as he gradually gets rid of this load of pressures within himself, he begins truly to clean the inside of his own cup. And having attained as far as he can go in this, he will discover that when the inner consciousness of his mind and emotions are at rest, you will for the first time begin to experience the mystery of the invisible source of life. He will discover the teacher self when he is able to overcome the false teachings which he has permitted to overwhelm his life. It's the same problem as we have in the legend of the fallen angels, in which the human mind has fallen into the hopeless confusion of ignorance. Ignorance which can be either learned or unlearned, but ignorance which is at all times the handicap, that which stands between, that which prevents the unfoldment of the natural life. We find also that mystics and the whole Grail cycle is a mystical tradition, that mystics always have represented the feeling of an immediate personal communion with the divine. The mystic always has believed that the final way to know the truth is not to gain it from others, but to search it in the self, to gradually find ways to attain a mystical transcendency over the obligations of existence. So this type of thought is the principle behind mysticism, which is a gentle, loving dedication. And gradually, as the mind's subconscious pressures are relaxed, we discover the arrival or the emergence through vigil, which is a vigilance over self. We find that in this, the visions occur. Nearly all mysticism is accompanied by visions. Visions of something better and something greater. Those who have not accomplished also have visions. Visions of danger. Visions of fear. Visions of believing things to be worse than they are. Believing that they have a right to hate people who do not hate them. All these things are the negative visions. But when the mystic has his visions, he beholds an inner life, a betterness. He has the experience of an exaltation above the present state of his affairs. Almost all religious art is aimed at this level of the individual's growth, namely the level of portraying, figuring, symbolizing in some tangible way the intangibles of the inner life, that in some way the meditation upon a sacred picture helps to strengthen this inner resolve, helps to make the inner life quiet, peaceful, and beautiful. Everything that helps to make our inner life beautiful is bringing us along the path. Everything that comes along that makes our inner life discordant or defaced or deformed is contributing to hindrance. And the great hindrances are the pressures of personal ambition, personal pride, and the desire to accumulate worldly goods. All these things have to be worked out by those who are going to seek for the mysterious crusade for the Grail, who are going to search for the cup of eternity. So this brings the individual to the next general feeling. From the purification of himself comes also then the strengthening of his inner realization of deity. Of course, we all have more or less idealistic concepts of God. But these concepts are very much of a material nature. God becomes a person, like the figure on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel in Rome, where God is casting off the sun and the moon, and where with a very long beard and a very patriarchal look, he reaches out to the hand of Adam. These physical things are the way we inevitably and instinctively think of deity. We think of deity either as a patriarchal figure or a matriarchal figure. We think of deity as father, mother, or father-mother. we think of a parental person. We look around us and we see a very nice-looking, patriarchal people and have a feeling that they sort of look a little like the way God must look. But to the mystic, this is not possible. The mystic must also realize, in the course of his growth, that he must try to find some nobler way of experiencing or inwardly visualizing the nature of deity. This is brought out in the mandala meditations of the East, where the effort is to reconstruct a spiritual universe as a reality which can be contemplated, which can become a new geography based in a divine light. But even here, the danger still exists that these things are merely an attenuating of physical factors. There is apparently no positive approach to the nature of deity. We can tell what it is not, but when it comes to tell what it is, there is always a certain uncertainty. But in the search of meditation, we find almost all mystical schools have religious observances, not observances demanded by some system. When they're demanded by a system, they're very dangerous. But a natural desire to understand more of the substance of things unseen. And this becomes the basis of a meditational development. The individual may meditate in the presence of sacred objects which have a tendency to lift the mind, but are themselves transitory, but they are part of the growth process which must be gone through. The Eastern Christian monk, gazing with meditative veneration at the icon of one of his saints or a beautiful picture of the Virgin Mary. These have a tendency to discriminate. They cause the individual to find joy in that which is truly the source of joy, rather than to find joy in little things, mortal preoccupations that have no essential meaning. Everything that helps in the constructive yearning towards reality. And then we come to another problem of hindrances which has to be considered, and that is, do people really want this? Does the individual really want to live this kind of a quest? Or is it going to gradually turn on him as a frustration in which he is miserable trying to be good? If such is the case, he has to stop immediately. Because unless the moods that grow in him fulfill him and make him happier than he ever was before, then something is basically wrong in the work he is attempting. He is never supposed to give up the world with a terrible sense of loss. If he does, he should stay where he is. He should give up the world only when in his heart and soul he is rejoicing at having discovered something greater than the world, something more important, something that he can love more fully, more completely, and more permanently. And if this does not appear, then this step of the quest is a failure. And many of the knights of the Round Table tried these different quests, which are very interesting, because only one or two of the whole group ever saw the Grail. Something always stopped them. The thing that stopped them was their own lack of worthiness. They got sidetracked. They got mixed up in something else. And gradually the vision of the quest faded away. They still believed in it, but the belief in it was not the quest itself. It never can be. We can believe in anything, but unless the believing transforms ourselves, it is of no basic value or permanence. But assuming that the individual has gotten this far in one piece and is going along fairly well, then we have these rungs of the ladder of meditation. We find the problem of growth involves not only the transformation of evil, but the glorification of good. The individual in order to really understand life, the great world of divine principles and causes, was placed in a garden where he was supposed to name all things according to their natures. He has rather named all things according to his own likes and dislikes, which is not the same thing. But in all of this problem, he has to recognize the importance of the experiences of growth. For instance, the mind must be developed. The various arts and sciences are rungs of a ladder. The individual is not wrong because he's a biologist. He's not wrong because he happens to be a grammarian. It is all a problem of what he is inwardly motivated by. If he is properly motivated, all sciences, arts, philosophies, crafts, and trades are equally sacred. If he is not so motivated, they are all equally profane. Therefore, it is not that the individual should walk away from experience or try to go off somewhere and live in a hermit cell for the rest of his life or renounce humanity. A great many people just renounce humanity and they try to get along without it. They try to leave behind every disagreeable task. They resent every social restriction. They dislike constantly the ineffectiveness of governments and religions and educations and everything, and come out very desperately against prevailing systems. This doesn't do much good. It constantly adds to a negative sense of criticism. It proves that the individual is still functioning without the gleam of eternal light that should be within himself. So he has to start in and look over everything he doesn't like and find out why it is important, why he needs it, why he must understand it, and very often why he must transcend it by a full action of consciousness. So the individual who tries to excuse his weaknesses by pointing out the weaknesses of other people is not moving in the right direction at all. The person who wishes to make a donation of their lives to a divine cause must have something to give. They must have an achievement, an accomplishment, a value that can be used in life. We must not bury the talent or the talents. We must use them if we would be called good and faithful servants. So by using the talents, we are able to gain not only a certain and additional ability to live well in this world, but at the same time, we are beginning to gain a better insight of the dimensions of that greater world we aspire to. We have to realize that all of the arts and sciences are like radiant stars suspended in a universal heaven. They bring light where darkness would otherwise be. We have to learn to recognize that knowledge is not bad. If it's true knowledge, it is very good. But to accept it as knowledge is not enough. We must find the spiritual soul behind knowledge. We must find the divine reality from which all forms of knowledge are suspended. If we do not accomplish this, we can go out and abuse knowledge and throw our world into war and disaster.